Hi, I'm Erwin McManus, and this is the Mosaic Podcast. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And if you're one of our regular listeners, we love the fact that you journey with us. And we pray that every single message inspires you and helps you become the person that God created you to be. Every single week, we send a new message across the world. And everything we do here at Mosaic is made available to everyone in the world for absolutely free. The reason we can do that is that we have incredible people who give generously and sacrificially to make this possible. And I want to invite you to join us. If you're already a giver, thank you so much. If this is something you've not yet done, I want to invite you to start doing that now. Go to mosaic.org/give and give a one-time gift, or even beyond that, become a recurring giver here at Mosaic. And if you're one of those individuals who God has blessed in an amazing way financially, I want to invite you to become one of our partners here at Mosaic. What's really beautiful about Mosaic is that our biggest givers are families who do not live here in Los Angeles, but they are so committed to the message of Jesus going to the world that they support the work here from Los Angeles to the ends of the earth. And so I want to invite you again, go to mosaic.org/give, become a part of our support system, become one of our partners. And more than anything else, I want you to listen to the message, allow Jesus to speak to you in a way that will change your life. If we pay attention carefully enough to the stories that we tell, especially here where we live, where stories seem to emerge and spread across the world, there are certain stories that if they were not real, we would have to invent them. If they never happened, we would have to create them. Stories that somehow resonate with us and connect to us at the deepest level. One of those stories is always the story about love, whether it's Pride and Prejudice or The Notebook or Silver Lining Playbook, the promise that there's someone for everyone, or Dune, a great love story. You laugh. There's something about love stories that pull us in because all of us hope that one day we too might be in our own love story. It's the promise that no matter how much pain we've gone through, no matter how much brokenness, no matter how much disappointment, no matter how many relationships we've stepped into and stepped out of, that the story isn't over until you've come to know love and love has come to know you. But there are other stories, as profound and as powerful as our search for love, for this epic romance that might carry us away. There's also those stories about heroism and bravery, like Band of Brothers and Gladiator and Fury, Best Job Ever, and Dune. Because all of us hope against hope that when the moment comes, in that moment where you're needed, you would step up to be that heroic person. That you would even surprise yourself, that you would find a level of bravery inside of yourself that you yourself would have to acknowledge you were a legend. Because you showed up when others disappeared. There are certain stories that demand us, that compel us, that call us out and call us forward and seem to connect at the deepest level of who we are. It's almost as if those stories heal us. Because when your heart is broken, you remember that love is a story that keeps being told over and over again with a promise. In those moments when you find yourself a coward and you find yourself shrinking back and not being the person you know you can be, those stories, they beckon you, they remind you, well, today was not your best day, but there's still a hero inside of you waiting to be awakened. Don't give up on who you can become. We're in the middle of a story even now. Because there are certain stories, again, that if they were not true, we would have to invent them. And here we find the story of God intervening on behalf of humanity. Who would ever think of a story like this? Who would ever come up with an idea like this, that that all of reality could be inverted, that the creator would become creation, that the one who is spirit would take on flesh and blood, that the one who is eternal would actually step into time and space. Who would ever think of a story like that? And why do we need that story? If the poets are right, you're more than just the material of your physical body, that there's an entire universe inside of you. Sometimes you feel it, don't you? That endless universe that keeps expanding inside of you, that goes deeper and deeper. And sometimes when you look inside of yourself, you get lost because you don't even know how deep you go. It's almost as if you could drop a penny in a well of your soul and it never hits the bottom. You have a sense that you too are infinite. But if there is a universe inside of us, and this we may not be certain of, but what we can be certain of is that if there is a universe inside of us, that universe is torn and broken and shattered. When you look inside of yourself, if it's anything like looking inside of me, I know that there is a tear in the fabric of time and space. And it doesn't materialize itself in the same way as it does in the cosmos, but it feels like sadness sometimes. And I feel that tear in the fabric of my time and space. Sometimes it feels like loneliness. Sometimes it feels like an unexplainable emptiness that no matter how much I attain in this life, it leaves me unfulfilled. It's like a black hole consuming all the light in me. Sometimes that tear in the fabric of the time and space of me, it feels like despair or anxiety or stress or feeling overwhelmed by life. And sometimes it feels like a sense of insignificance, because in that universe inside of you, you feel like you're just a speck of dust. And maybe you just come and go, and that's all there is. And so we come to this moment in the life of Jesus that is the end of his story, or at least so it seems. And in the middle of the story, we find this very peculiar thing happening. And it shouldn't surprise us that there are things that are going to be described that seemed incredulous. Listen to what Matthew writes. And I want to be clear. Some people say, well, you know, there's only one document that tells you about Jesus and tells you about the crucifixion and tells you about the resurrection. There's only one book that tells you the story of God with humanity. How can you trust one book? And I want you to realize that there are 66 books wrapped up in this one book. It wasn't one book. It's many books brought together because the stories seem to have the fabric of truth interwoven between them that guides us on the story of us. And even with Jesus, there are at least four people, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they were so different than each other. And they didn't even seem to collaborate. Because when they wrote the four Gospels, they said so many different things about the same moment. It's almost, were you in the same room? Were you listening to the same conversation? Have you ever been in a moment with friends? Three or four friends, and you all have an experience, and then later you're talking about it, and everyone remembers it differently? You're the only one who remembers it right. Everyone else got it wrong. But you remembered what affected you, what pierced you, what marked you. And they remembered what affected them, what pierced them, what marked them. And every person is telling the story not from what happened, but from how what happened affected them. And so one of the ways you can know that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John are writing their credible experiences that they didn't match. You can always tell when people are lying because they meet to make sure their stories line up. You know what I'm talking about. You have to make sure you get all the details the same. Because nothing requires a great memory like lying. But they all told the story from where they were and how they experienced it, and how it came to them, and how it stayed with them. And so Matthew writes these words in chapter 27, beginning in verse 50 through 54. And this is at the very last moment when Jesus is being crucified. This is the very last moment where Jesus takes his last breath. And it says, "And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Now, in this moment, there are things being described that go beyond belief. And if these things are easy for you to believe, you need to be a little more skeptical. Because if you believe the story that we're in the resurrection of Jesus, I want you to realize you should not be judgmental or condescending in relationship to your friends that do not believe. They're the rational ones. When you believe this, there's a mental pliability that has now entered into your brain that no one else can explain except the act of God. And Jesus is being crucified, and in that moment where he takes his last breath, it's as if all of creation is shaken, that there is in this moment a tear in the fabric of time and space. In fact, Luke describes it like this in chapter 23, verses 44 through 46. He adds this texture. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. For the sun stopped shining. I love the way he describes that. So it goes pitch black at noon till 3. It's so odd that Luke tells us this and the others seem to overlook it. How do you overlook letting us know that everything went black? It's because there were other things happening that caught their attention. So it was pitch black for 3 hours, and he says, and the sun stopped shining. Now, it would make more sense to say, and the sun was eclipsed. Or dark clouds covered the sky and covered the effect of the sun. But he doesn't tell us that. He says the sun stopped shining because in that moment, what they were experiencing was all of time and space collapsing together, changing all the rules of reality. If you took the beginning of time and held it in one hand and took the end of time and held it in the other hand and bent it together, it would break at the cross. And the sun stopped shining. Everything stopped doing what it's supposed to do. All of creation was in disarray. Matthew reminds us that the earth shook. It's as if the earth needed to tremble, even when we did not. The rocks split. And in the same description, he says, and the tombs broke open. I'm amazed that the earth was shaking and that rocks were splitting, but I would not put them in the same category as tombs were breaking open. Then he says this so casually. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. And then he explains a little more. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Now remember, he's writing this while those many people were still alive. They go, yeah, I'm one of those many people. Can you imagine being one of the people in Jerusalem who happens now to see someone who was dead and now they're alive? Yes, they were seen by many people who could never forget that memory and lived in trauma for the rest of their lives because they were seeing dead people come back to life. I don't like rules. There are a few predictable things in life that attract me, but I do want some things to be consistent. I mean, imagine if nothing was consistent in your life. If every day your apartment changed without telling you. Every day you'd get up, you'd go to work, and then when you went back home, you had to figure out where you lived. Some of you are saying, that is my life. But there's a nice consistency of knowing that you have a place, knowing that you have a bed, knowing that you have a coffee shop you go to every day. Any of you have your life traumatized because your favorite coffee shop closed down? What are they doing to me? They don't understand my need for something that's consistent. One of the things I really appreciate is, even though I'm not a fan of death, I appreciate its consistency. I like the fact that when we're here, we're here. And when we're gone, we're gone. There are people I miss who have passed away, but I don't really want to see them by surprise. I don't want them just to show up, ignoring the rules, and just walking down the street and saying, guess what? I'm back. I want a consistency of life and death, the beginning and end, and I want a consistency of time and space, of eternity, of the infinite and limitless. There's something beautiful. Can you imagine if every day you had to negotiate with gravity, how it would operate? If you never really quite knew, today's heavier. You have to just fight more. Some days are lighter. You kind of hop along the world, just bouncing down the street. Because we oftentimes don't even realize how we operate under the consistency of creation. But when Jesus was torn, there was a tear in the fabric of time and space. Everything turned upside down. The earth that rotates shook. The rocks that are constant split. The tombs that remain closed open. I do appreciate the fact that he emphasizes the body of many holy people who had died were raised to life. This wasn't sort of like one of those prison release programs where anyone can get out, okay? That would have been a really bad day in Jerusalem. It felt a lot like L.A. It was as if Jesus wanted us to understand that what he did was simply not singular. It was first, but it wasn't only. And the tombs broke open, the bodies of people who had died were raised to life, and they came out and were walking around the city. And then even those who should not believe suddenly believed. In verse 54, it says, when the centurion, now a centurion is a Roman soldier who has position and power. He has 100 men under him. And these are the most well-trained, disciplined soldiers in the world. And this centurion who had his 100 and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened. And all that would happen was that the sun stopped shining for 3 hours, that rocks were shattering, that the earth was shaking, and that dead men and women were walking the earth as if it was normal. And when the centurion who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified. Of course they were terrified. They could feel the tear in the fabric of time and space, and they didn't know where it was going to end. And exclaimed, surely he was the Son of God. Now remember, this centurion would have pledged his allegiance to Caesar. He would have declared Caesar God. He would have no other God besides Caesar and all the other gods of the Roman pantheon. But not Jesus. Because you can't add Jesus to your gods. To declare Jesus would be to declare that all those other gods were no gods at all. And that Caesar was not God, but a deluded, narcissistic emperor. You think a centurion would say that without thought and to understand the implications of that moment? But there's a little statement that sort of laced in here that can be so easily missed. In verse 51, it says, at that moment, the curtain of the temple, also called the veil, at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now you think, well, of course, a curtain will be torn. I mean, everything is in disarray. The earth is shaking. Rocks are breaking. Of course, a curtain will tear. I'm sure we've all had a curtain tear at some point in our life, or fabric tear. That happens, the fabric, except for one really specific thing. If you look at the design of this curtain, of this veil, it was 60 feet long and 30 feet wide. And it was as thick as the palm of a man's hand, which would be about 4 inches thick. This veil, this curtain, was so immense that they write in the records that it takes around 300 priests to manipulate that curtain, to move it, because of its weight and strength. And Josephus, who was a secular historian, a Jewish historian, who later, he was a warrior for the Jews, later betrayed the Jews and sided with the Romans, but he wrote a lot of history. Now, he was not a follower of Jesus, but he wrote about the things that happened around the time of Jesus. And Josephus explained that you could take two horses and tie them to each side of the curtain, of each side of the veil, and you could not tear that veil apart. So even if the insurrectionists came in to destroy the temple and to defile that place. And this veil was significant in the culture and the religion and the beliefs of the Israelites, of the Hebrews. Because on the other side of that veil was the Holy of Holies. And only one time a year, one person who was selected, the high priest, could go across that veil and enter into the Holy of Holies and have a meeting with God. Of course, that was in theory. Because what we know is for 400 years, the priest would go across the veil and God was not there. There was a time he was there. There was a memory of God, but no reality of God. That's how religions are born. Where you have a moment, you meet God, and you mark it as sacred. And so you keep going back to the same place even if God doesn't. So for 400 years, those high priests would enter in an empty space, and it must have filled them with so much dismay that God would not show up, and there must have been an incredible sense of fear that God would never return to them. That veil, that curtain, was a symbol of the separation between God and all humanity. And in this moment, when Jesus, the creator of the universe, was torn in two, in this moment, when there was a tear in the fabric of time and space, it tells us that God tore that temple, but it was torn from top to bottom. That's significant. Because if men had come in to tear it, it would have torn from bottom to top. But that veil was torn from heaven to earth by the hand of God so that God could remove any barrier between you and him. You don't have to go find a holy place that's divided by a curtain. Every place you are, where you open yourself to God, is that holy place. There's this riddle that has become very popular, not only in recent times, but for generations, really, it seems. But certainly, I've heard it in my lifetime, that if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, does it make a sound? And that riddle, I think, proposes really two important questions. One is, are we the center of the universe? I think the reason we ask that question is because we think we're the center of the universe. If a tree falls and we don't hear it, how can it make a sound? Aren't we the center of the universe? If something happens and we're not aware of it, did it really happen? If something happened and we don't believe it, doesn't it mean it doesn't exist? Your perception is the boundary of your reality, but it is not the boundary of reality. So if a tree falls in the middle of the forest, it makes a sound whether you or I hear it or not. Because we're not the ones that are listening that matter most. kind of an interesting thing to me that sometimes we think that if we're not there, there does not exist. I appreciate the clarity of some things. Like, I know that I'm here, and I'm not there. I know where I am, I know where I'm not, I'm here, not there. And maybe in some other metaphysical way you can say I'm here and there, but then you're neither here nor there. But what I do know is when I'm standing in Los Angeles, I'm not standing in London, and I'm not standing in Paris, and I'm not standing in Tokyo. And so there's a clarity that I'm here, not there. But here's the problem. When you begin to convince yourself that because you're here, there does not exist, that's when you miss what God might be doing. See, there are people who don't believe God exists, and they think because they don't believe God exists that God does not exist, because God is actually a manifestation of their own perception. But that's like saying, I've never been to China, and I'm not there, and so I've never experienced it, so I know it doesn't exist. It could only exist once I've walked Beijing. Reality doesn't come into existence when you step into that reality. Reality is waiting for you to open yourself up to more than what you know. And I know it's hard to believe in the afterlife because, well, we're here, not there. So it's hard to believe in life after death because here we are in life before death, or maybe death before death, or existence before death. Whatever it is, we know it's before death. And so we know we're here and we're not there. So when someone talks to us about life after death, they go, well, I don't know. You need someone who's been there and then comes here to let us know that here is not all there is, that there's a there waiting for us. So Jesus tears the fabric of time and space, and he who is eternal steps into the now, into this moment, and then allows himself to be crucified. But time cannot hold down eternity, nor death, life, nor hate, love, or despair, hope. So the end result was inevitable. And when Jesus rose from the dead, he was both here and there. And inviting us into that same experience. Have you ever felt like you're suffocating in the confines of time and space? So little time. It slips so fast. Life really is like the sands of an hourglass, slipping away, slipping away, slipping away. It can be suffocating when you realize you can't escape it. Space, if you care to dwell on it too long, it can become suffocating, that you're trapped within the confines of this created space, and yet you feel as if there's something transcendent inside of you, and it's so confusing when you have the essence of the eternal in you, but you feel so trapped inside of what's created. And what Jesus came to do is to redefine reality for us, to bend the spectrum of time and space and break it at the cross and elevate us through the resurrection to where we're no longer trapped in time and space, but live within it and beyond it at the same time. You know, the second question that we ask when we talk about the tree falling in the forest, does it make a sound if no one hears it, I think is a more existential question. When you fall, does anyone hear you? When I live and I die, well, if no one remembers me, will I have lived at all? If I'm just a speck of dust, a dash in the spectrum of history, did my life make any sound at all? Or am I like a tree that has fallen in the forest and no one was there to hear me cry? Hear me sing, hear me shout, hear me declare, I am here. I am alive. A very odd thing happened at the end of this. The Pharisees and the Sadducees were really concerned about how the story was going to get twisted, because they understood that what was happening here was the most profound story that has ever been lived. Not ever been told, but lived. It was yet to be told. It was only being lived. And they were terrified that the story that was being lived out by Jesus would be told by those who were changed by him. And so they planned and plotted. In Matthew 27, beginning of verse 62, it says, the next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days, I will rise again. They remember that now. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell people that he has been raised from the dead. That's a story we cannot allow to get out. This last deception will be worse than the first. Take a guard, Pilate answered. Go and make the tomb as secure as you know how. And so they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the tomb and posting a guard. They were terrified that the story of Jesus' life wasn't finished. They remembered the story he told, that on the third day he would rise from the dead, that on the third day he would conquer death. On the third day, life and love would prevail. And they were terrified that this story could not be stopped. Why would they think the disciples would do that? Can you imagine being a disciple of Jesus, giving 3 years of your life to him, and then he doesn't come through? I mean, he may have been sincere, but he was sincerely wrong. You just watched him get crucified. All of your hopes and dreams were destroyed in this man's failure, in his delusion. In fact, if anything, you would have sensed bitterness seeping into your soul. How could he deceive us like this? You would not have been plotting to tell a story that wasn't true about a person who lied to you. Have you ever noticed how people talk about their exes online, in social media? You ever watch some of those conversations? Now, I think a lot of times it's more the women talking about their ex-boyfriends. He's such a jerk. He's a narcissist. They all are. The proof that the guy is a narcissist is that he's not dating you anymore. Right? Oh, man, he's not faithful. He's immature. He's not a grown man. He's just a boy. And you see all these things online. And yet you have to wonder, why did you date him? And why did you go back to him 4 times? If all you can remember are all these negative things, you know why? Because when your heart's broken, you cannot remember why you love them. You can only remember why you hate them. And same way with men when they write about or talk about their exes. Most of the guys don't write about their exes. They just talk about them. They don't want proof of their shallowness. And they talk about their exes. Yeah, she's shallow. She's nothing. Yeah. She's not worth a lifetime commitment, you know. She's just another one of them. So you dumped her. You broke up with her. Well, no, not exactly. You know. Yeah. I was about to break up with her when she broke up with me. And she just got there faster. She saw it coming. And you know what you never see online? He was amazing. I mean, I could have never dated a better guy. He was generous, he was kind, he was compassionate. In fact, the only reason we broke up is I just didn't deserve him. I wish I could have, but I just couldn't live up to how amazing he was as a human being. Ladies, he's available. You should run. Because if he picks you, it's going to be the greatest moment of your life. No one ever writes that. There are no 5-star Yelp reviews for exes. No one says it about their ex. Oh, she was amazing. She was so understanding, and she never made me buy an expensive meal. She loves sports. She even went Dutch by paying 100%. She was incredible. And no guy ever says that. And it's so odd to me that even when you go back to someone over and over again, all you remember is everything that's wrong with them. You know why? Because bitterness has a way of reshaping the story. Betrayal has a way of reshaping the story. Your wounding has a way of reshaping the story. Do you really think Jesus' disciples would tell a story about Jesus that covered his betrayal to them? Why were they so afraid? Maybe it's because some stories, if they were not true, we would have to create them. Because our souls so desperately need to believe that this could happen. Such a ridiculous story that the creator of the universe would step into creation, that God would become human, that in all of your imperfection, in all of your brokenness, in all of your shortcomings, that he could not stop loving you. What an absurd story. Have you ever known love like that? Have you ever experienced the relentless pursuit of love that you cannot shake loose, no matter how broken or dark or self-absorbed you are? It's an insane story that God refuses to give up on us. And it's the story that our souls have been waiting to be told. Because we're created for this kind of love. There's something inside of you that knows there's a tear in the fabric of time and space. There's a brokenness, a sadness, a loneliness, a despair, an anger, a disappointment, a sense of insignificance or unworthiness, the toxic nature of guilt and shame flooding into your soul day after day after day. I do think it's interesting that Sigmund Freud, who was the father of psychiatry, launched his first psychiatric office on Easter Sunday. That's a terrible strategy for a business. Unless you're trying to make a statement, we no longer need God. We can now heal ourselves. If time has proven anything, is that Sigmund was terribly, terribly wrong. As advanced as we become, as much technology as we create, as brilliant and extraordinary as this human species is, there's still a tear within us waiting to be healed. And only Jesus can heal it. 2,000 years ago, God sent his son to die for us. Torn in two. Crucified, buried, raised from the dead. So that the universe inside of you could be healed. And I wonder if today, in this moment we call now, it's time for you to step into eternity. This moment, to me, I think, oh, it's so small. How could God possibly meet us in this moment? He's infinite. He's eternal. Does he become small enough to meet us here? No. He makes this moment big enough for eternity to rush into your soul, for forgiveness to come, for freedom to come, for life to come, for love to come. And it all comes when you open your life to Jesus and make him your Lord and your God. Would you bow your heads with me just for a moment? Close your eyes. Sometimes you have to look inside and see what's inside of you before you can see what God wants to bring to you. You have to see the tear, the wound, the brokenness inside of you to understand why Jesus came to heal you and to make you whole. Sometimes you have to see the darkness inside of you to know why Jesus had to die, to pay the price for our sin and our brokenness. Sometimes we have to look inside of ourselves and have a moment of blunt honesty and say, I need God. And Jesus, I need you. And if that's you in this moment, and you're ready to put your life into Jesus' hands and cross the line of faith and follow him, I want you to pray this simple prayer. Jesus, I give you my life. That's it. Just start there. Just pray the simple prayer. Jesus, I give you my life. Jesus, I give you my life. That simple invitation will change your life. God will rush into this moment on your behalf. And eternity will be born in your heart. If this is your prayer tonight, Jesus, I give you my life, I want to pray for you. If your prayer is, Jesus, I give you my life, I want you to hold your hand up high right now without embarrassment, without hesitation, just hold it up high. There's nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to be hesitant about. When you ask love to change you, receive it fully. Anyone else? Beautiful. So many. Father, I thank you for each person who in this moment has opened themselves to you. I pray, God, you would wrap them up in your love and let them know they belong to you and that you will never leave them or abandon them. I pray, God, that they would just somehow know that in this moment you have flooded their soul with love and life and freedom and hope. They would trust you as the source of their life. Jesus, you are the great love story that our souls have been searching for. You are the great hero whose bravery has come to set us free. God, I am so grateful that you invite us into your story so that you might write a new story in us. So we thank you, Jesus. And we pray in your name. Amen.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Mosaic Podcast. As God has spoken into your life, one of the things that Jesus teaches us is that when we've been invested in, we need to also become investors. And I want to encourage you right now, if Mosaic is one of the platforms from which you grow spiritually, you connect more deeply to God, and your faith with Jesus becomes more real, I want to encourage you right now to go to mosaic.org and become one of our givers. Give a one-time gift, become a recurring giver, become a part of what God's doing across the world. Mosaic isn't just a church in Los Angeles. Mosaic is all of us working together.